And just like that, here we are at episode 20. Welcome all, and thanks for being here. This is History's Great Mysteries. As always, I am your host, Nick. And what can I say except that I'm very happy to be here for another day and another episode of A Great Mystery. But before I get started, a quick announcement. For those of you who have been following this podcast, you'll know that I recently had to take a break from releasing episodes just due to the fact that I started grad school and just absolutely did not have time to create quality episodes. And nobody has time for anything less than quality episodes, right? So this past month, actually, I did get a break from my studies and I was able to release a couple episodes, including this one. But unfortunately, I have to break the news now that my studies are resuming and I will have to hit the pause button once more until further notice. But please do keep updated with my Facebook page where I promise to keep you guys in the loop. However, today, let's just focus on the mystery at hand, what you're all here for. And let me tell you, this is definitely a mystery that calls for focus and calls for thinking outside of the box and, you know, definitely calls for you to channel your inner Sherlock Holmes, because what I have for you today is a world-renowned cold case out of Australia, a true thriller with enough twists and turns to be a blockbuster Hollywood movie. Also, definitely something for you true crime lovers out there as well. A case that I've been following for quite a while now, and I'm extremely excited to finally share with you. So get ready to develop your own theory as you listen along to Australia's most notorious unsolved cold case for the ages, the Somerton Man Mystery. Now, before I get started, I wanted to put out a brief heads up. This episode will touch on the topic of suicide, as it is very pertinent to the case. It can be a tough topic to discuss, so please take care and discretion when listening, and please take the time to educate yourself on how to handle mental health struggles, both personal and for those around you, either through resources online or direct outreach services that are set up in your country and community. And with that being said, let's go ahead and jump in. The year is 1948. The Cold War has just begun, the world is still reeling from World War II, and on a beach in southern Australia, a body is found. More specifically, Somerton Beach in Adelaide, Australia, on the morning of December 1st. It turns out to be the body of a man, a very well-dressed man, slumped up against a wall in a relaxed-looking position. So relaxed, in fact, that many people walking the beach early that morning thought that he was sleeping. But eventually, it became clear that this man was, in fact, dead. Seems straightforward so far, but let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the circumstances around this case are so bizarre and extraordinary. There is a reason that we still talk about it over 70 years later. The police arrive and scramble to gather all of the details that they can, and here's what they can initially piece together. A local resident by the name of John Lyons was walking the beach that previous night when he first saw this mysterious man. He was in the same position, lying in the sand with his head propped up in an odd position against the seawall at the back of the beach. His lower legs were crossed. He was immaculately dressed in full suit and tie, dress pants, and newly polished shoes. At this point in the night, he was evidently still alive, smoking a cigarette. John Lyons remarked to police that he saw him actually raise his right arm into the air in kind of an odd, jerky motion before it fell flat back against his body. This strange behavior, Lyons initially chalked up to the man just being the behavior of a drunk man and continued walking on. Another passerby noticed the man a little bit later on and saw mosquitoes flying around his face. She noted the strange clothing for the beach, but just kind of assumed that the man was asleep and went on her way. It wasn't until the light of next morning, December the 1st, until Lyons, that same guy, was passing by again, and he noticed the man still there, still in the exact same position, and this time not moving at all. In a later interview, it was said that people slowly began to kind of gather around the body, still unsure if this guy was blackout drunk or dead. One fellow eventually went down to kind of move his leg and got no response from the Somerton man, and it was decided that he was indeed quite dead. As police continued to peruse the scene, they made note of how pristine and well-kept this man appeared. Going further, there was absolutely no noticeable cause of death, with the body simply looking very relaxed. Upon further inspection of the corpse, they found no wallet, no documents, no meaningful belongings, nothing that could identify him immediately. And what's even more strange is that all of the tags on his clothing had been snipped off. So there was no way to, I mean, if they got lucky, maybe his name was on the tags, but even more than that, there was no way to determine where this clothing was from, and maybe perhaps where this man was from. The body made its way to Royal Adelaide Hospital a few hours later, and an autopsy was carried out. He was estimated at an age of 40 to 45. He had brushed back hair, medium weight, well-groomed, and his fingers were tobacco-stained. Dr. John Bakley Bennett put the time of death at somewhere around 2 a.m. that early morning. Moreover, he noted that the actual cause of death was not apparent, but that he expected heart failure. There were no signs of a hypodermic needle puncturing the skin anywhere, which they always want to look for, no lesions, no noticeable disease, no cerebral hemorrhaging, and more vaguely, he was able to learn a lot about the man just through general observation, noting that he was in strikingly good shape, with particularly muscular calves. In combination with this, his feet had a particular wedge shape to them, which gave the doctor the inclination that the Somerton man had a habit of wearing pointed shoes. This, with the muscular calves, made him think of ballet. And it was here that we have the first potential link made to ballet dancing, and this will come up a bit later. But moving on, looking at the stomach, he could see that there was a recent pasty eaten that day, on the previous day, and that there was a lot of blood in the stomach. Also working on the case was official pathologist John Cleland, who first put forward the notion, based on that coagulation of blood in the stomach and a distended liver, that poisoning could have been the culprit. These oddities started to add up to drastically change the outlook of the case for police, because now they have to consider the possibility of a murder. So for investigators, lots of questions are beginning to mount. How exactly did this man die? Under what circumstances? Was there foul play? Did anyone else see anything? Are there any other clues out there? Why does there appear to be an effort to keep his identity a mystery? And last but not least, at the end of the day, who is this man? Well, for a while, the police were absolutely stumped. This is a truth with almost all cases, but the first step in solving it would be to understand everything you can about the victim. But the authorities knew next to nothing. So they turned to seek help from the community, hoping, first of all, that perhaps someone could actually just look at him and identify him, or at least that maybe a missing persons report would come out in the next day or two, and they could match it up to this mystery man. But alas, days passed on, and neither of these things happened. What did keep the case alive, however, was the fact that clues slowly but surely started to trickle in. Firstly, I mentioned that he didn't have any meaningful belongings on him, but that's not to say he had absolutely nothing on him. In one of his trouser pockets, he had an unused train ticket and a bus ticket that was used, and this bus had evidently dropped him off somewhere near Somerton Beach. With an inquest at the train station, a couple of dots were actually connected. The day that the Somerton man booked his train ticket, a suitcase was left in the storage area there. This suitcase had never been retrieved, so investigators naturally considered that this suitcase most likely belonged to this man. Upon opening it, they found some clothing and shoes that matched the type and size that this Somerton man was wearing on the beach. What's more convincing, however, is this, and I'll read it straight from the official pathologist's notes. On a card in the suitcase is some orange-colored linen thread. I have examined this microscopically, and it corresponds microscopically in color and size of fibers with similar thread used to sew up a trouser pocket in the suitcase, buttons on the trouser taken off of the deceased, and where the coat collar of deceased had given way. The color is unusual, was warm sepia of Ridgeway, which apparently is a color that he was able to identify. Okay, so anyway, we have this suitcase belonging to this man. Great. What more can we gain from it? Also in the pathologist notes, we have a note that the coat looked to be American-made. Secondly, we have the name Keane, K-E-A-N-E, written on some of the clothing within this suitcase. However, in one instance, Keane is spelled K-E-A-N with no E at the end in two different articles of clothing, which is a little bit confusing. Initially, they thought maybe this is his last name, but, you know, something more is going on here, right? And they couldn't ignore the fact that this may have been a deliberate attempt to falsify his identity and keep his true identity secret. Because again, we have tags being removed from everything, and by all accounts, it seems that this Somerton man went to great lengths to keep his identity hidden through his death. Now, are we even completely sure that it was the Somerton man himself that went to these lengths, or perhaps his killer, if we are allowing the possibility for murder? Either way, even with this new clue, we seem to be no closer to getting any answers. This is at least until the next clue rolled in. Our pathologist John Cleland can be thanked for bringing this one to light. Again, I will read it directly from the file. In an easily overlooked small money pocket on the right side of the front trousers was a small piece of paper torn from its context with imprint in large letters to Mom Should. I understand it is Arabic for completely, wholly. This may suggest the intention to commit suicide, but if this was meant to be found, why place it in a small pocket likely to be overlooked? He was evidently acquainted with Turkish or Arabic. Had he served in the army or visited as a sailor? So yes, let me clarify here. In a small, semi-hidden pocket in his pants, the investigators discovered this small piece of paper that was evidently torn out of a book that contained the words Tamam Shud, which are actually Persian. And this is actually a source of some misconception in the case. Many online and many articles online that talk about this case kind of have this assumption that this pocket where these words were found was like a secret pocket that was like sewn in by himself, hand sewn in somewhere random in his pants. Like, that's not exactly what it was. It was an unremarkable pocket, but it was a standard smaller pocket that was kind of in the front where someone could hold a pocket watch. It's like a fob pocket. It was something that is known. I actually still see them around today as well. Like, you could put little coins in there or maybe a pocket watch in there. It just wasn't his main pocket. It was easily overlooked, yes, but it wasn't like deliberately sewn in somewhere. So keep this in mind later when I go over the theories. Now, initially, the investigators had no clue what to make of this or where these words had been ripped out of. It took an interested and well-read member from the local community to enlighten the investigators that this term came directly from a book called the Rubaiyat. This book is actually a collection of Persian poems from around the year 1100. Specifically, Tamam Shud is the closing phrase at the end of all of the poems. It has been translated to roughly mean the end or finished or it is finished. So of course, the next thought for some people like the pathologist is, okay, maybe this was a suicide note of sorts. It is finished. He ripped it out of the book for a reason, and to this day, many who hold tightly to the theory that the Somerton Man case is a suicide case will use this as the strongest piece of evidence. But for investigators, this case was nowhere near solved. And this is when another realization began to set in. If he ripped this out of a copy of the Rubaiyat, then perhaps that book that he ripped it out of is still out there somewhere with, you know, the words Tamam Shud ripped out of the last page. Well, they posed this question to the community, has anyone seen this book? And they waited. In the meantime, a local expert chemist had finished running blood and organ tests on the Somerton man and reported the findings to investigators. What he told them baffled them and immediately made the case even more complex. These tests failed to reveal even the smallest trace of poison in the system. I mean, they had been fully expecting poisoning and to be able to finally write down a cause of death after it all, but unfortunately, the truth continued to elude them. Poisoning was not it. It's actually quite haunting to look at the official death certificate for the Somerton man that I have here. It's quite bone-chilling when you think about it, really. Under name and surname, it says unidentified male body, occupation not known, birthplace not known, cause of death not known. I mean, this is a guy's entire life, a real man that had untold adventures and love and loss and struggle and triumph, and this is what we have on him at the end of the day. And, you know, for those of you who want to take a look at this or any other file that I'm discussing in the episode, of course, you can take a look on my Facebook page underneath the post for this podcast episode. But anyways, I digress. The pathologist cannot pin down poisoning as the culprit, and the big questions of the case remain. It is worth mentioning that the coroner on the case and many other investigators involved actually still suspected poisoning after all of this. A respected professor at the local university suggested that it could have been a type of poison that is very rare, or at least rarely used as poison, in that it decomposes quickly after death and leaves no trace. Specifically, he suggested perhaps digitalis or strophanthin. Digitalis is a super common heart medication, actually, or it was more common in that time, that was generally used to enhance the contractile strength of the heart. However, I'm sure you can imagine what too much of this drug could do. And strophanthin, on the other hand, is really quite rare, only seen in euthanasia for lethal injection. It's derived from an African plant that, when ingested, acts directly onto the heart and no other organs. And again, too much of it, and you can have lethal cardiac arrest. These two drugs are so uncommonly used as, you know, quote-unquote poison, and they act so quickly with no other consequences other than that cardiac arrest, that it's not unreasonable to think that a standard toxicity blood and organ test would miss them. So the investigators are still there, scratching their heads, wishing and hoping for a new lead to pop up. Fingerprints weren't giving any match. People from all over continued to come in and try to identify the man to no avail. No missing persons reports were matching his description, and nothing new had amounted from that briefcase that was left at the train station. The trails were starting to turn cold, and time was passing, and they couldn't keep the corpse in the morgue forever, so eventually they had to give him a proper burial. But before doing so, they made a cast of the outline of his upper half, starting from about below his shoulders all the way to the top of his head. And this detailed white cast really showed his features and his face so that it could be used in the future to hopefully identify him even while he's buried underneath the ground. However, a full 8 months after the body was found on Somerton Beach, nothing had happened. That is, until a man walked into the police station carrying a copy of the Rubaiyat. And yes, what you're thinking is correct. This copy of the Rubaiyat had a portion of the final page ripped out. When held up against the piece of paper that was found with the Somerton man, they did indeed fit perfectly together. This book was definitively linked to the Somerton man. Obviously, the guy was immediately questioned, the guy that walked in with it, about, you know, how he came into possession of this book. And his story was this. He keeps a car parked a few hundred yards away from Somerton Beach, usually with the windows rolled slightly down. One day, soon after the discovery of the body, he took that car for a spin and found a strange book lying on the floorboards in the back seat. He initially made nothing of it, kind of just thinking, that's strange. Is this book mine? He put it in the glove box and then kind of forgot about it. But months later, when reading a newspaper article about the case, he realized that he had that exact book that investigators were looking for. He grabbed it and brought it in, and that's that. Now, we can talk about how weird this story is a bit later, but for now, the investigators were just happy to have a new lead. So what could be gained from the book? Well, for the most part, it seemed like a pretty normal copy of the Rubaiyat. That is, until you turned to the inside of the back cover, where it appears that the Somerton man, or at least someone, had scribbled a bunch of letters in what seems to be only describable as a code, a cipher. And I have pictures of this as well, but I can quickly read it out to you guys. In all capital letters, we have WRGOABABD. Then we have one more letter on a line below, but strangely, this line has been kind of crossed out. But behind it, we can see the letters MLIAOI. And then the line below that that isn't crossed out is WTBIMDAKETP. Then the single letter X that is crossed out. Then another new line below it, MLIABOAIAQC. Then finally the last line, ITTMTSAAMSTGAB. So as I'm sure you can appreciate, this code is truly just gibberish and nonsense unless, you know, you have the way to decode it. And I'm sure you're wondering, has it been cracked? Has anyone managed to solve it? Well, my listener, I can tell you that the answer is no. This code remains unsolved to this day, but it isn't for lack of effort. Many individuals and universities and investigators and teams have tried their luck at cracking this code, but everyone has come up empty. Some have said that there just isn't enough to go off of. We would need more lines and more letters to draw any kind of conclusion. And for me personally, when I looked at this code, my first thought was, okay, do these letters correspond to words at certain locations within the Rubaiyat, maybe the beginning of words? And evidently, this is a thought that many have looked into already. The Australian Naval Intelligence, for instance, is quoted as saying, "The frequency of the occurrence of letters, whilst inconclusive, corresponds more favorably with the table of frequencies of initial letters of words in English than with any other table." Accordingly, a reasonable explanation would be that the lines are the initial letters of words of a verse of poetry or such like. But even so, the code remains unbroken. And despite this roadblock, however, there was one more silver lining to finding the correct copy of the Rubaiyat. Because below this code was written a sequence of numbers. A sequence of numbers that police believed must be a local phone number. So what else to do but find out who the number belongs to? Well, when they did track it down, it turned out that the number belonged to a local 27-year-old woman by the name of Jo Thompson, sometimes also referred to as Jessica Thompson. She went by a lot of pseudonyms throughout her life. As it turns out, Jo Thompson lived only a mere minute's walk away from Somerton Beach. When the police brought her in, they, of course, showed her the cast of the Somerton Man and said, you know, do you know him? Officially, she went on record to say that she did not know that man. However, the taxidermist and the investigators that were in the room at that time remark that she definitely had a visceral reaction to seeing the man, so much so that she apparently almost fainted. And despite this, she looked them in the eye afterwards and said that she did not know who it was. It's strange, definitely, to say the least, but the police couldn't do much more to press her case any further. They did, however, also ask her about that copy of the Rubaiyat and why perhaps her phone number was in the back. Initially, she was very, very reluctant to even just talk to the investigators, but sooner or later, they did get it out of her that years back, while working as a nurse in World War II, she actually gave a copy of the Rubaiyat to a young man that she had met during this time. And then she then gave investigators this man's name, Alfred Boxall. Well, that's cut and dry then, right? I mean, I'm sure the investigators thought so. Cut, print, nice and neat. The case is solved. The Somerton Man must be Alfred Boxall. However, there was one problem. The real Alfred Boxall was still alive and well, living in New South Wales. Upon further investigation and interviews with Boxall, it became clear that Joe Thompson's story seemed to add up. He did know Joe, they had met during the war, and what's more, he still possessed that copy of the Rubaiyat that Joe had given him. He presented it to police, all intact, and it even contained a little handwritten note from Joe. So, just as quickly as hope came, a dead end came soon afterwards. Police continued to poke and prod around the case, getting a few more bits and pieces of the mystery. For one, Jo Thompson was actually pregnant during this time, but with no husband. Secondly, neighbors of Jo remember that in the previous year, a man outside of her house was calling for her. And when I say previous year, I mean this has been a year since the Somerton Man was found. So back in the year of the Somerton Man being found, they couldn't remember the exact day. They remember some man yelling for Joe outside her house. Or there was also another potential witness on the beach that night that said he may have seen a man carrying another man on his shoulder near the water's edge of Somerton Beach, which is definitely intriguing. In 1949, another death occurred, this time the death of a man named George Marshall, who died by suicide on an Australian beach with, remarkably, a copy of the Rubaiyat open on his chest. So coincidence is hard to picture here. But as far as the official police investigation goes, for the Somerton man, this is about where it ends. Everything from here on out that I talk about is kind of more the recent outside investigation and interest in the case. And for a lot of the more recent breakthroughs in the case, we have one man to thank, a professor from the University of Adelaide, one Derek Abbott. Derek Abbott has devoted an immeasurable amount of time and effort into the Somerton Man case, a mystery that is fair to say he is absolutely obsessed with solving. Now, he, like many of you I'm sure, had the inclination that there must be more to this Jo Thompson business than meets the eye. The fact that her phone number was in the book, the fact that she lived right next to Somerton Beach, and the fact that she almost fainted upon seeing his cast surely means that they must have some sort of connection. They must have known each other. Well, after decades of little to no public interest in the Somerton Man case, Abbott took this idea and ran with it. First, he wanted to track down Jo Thompson herself and have a word with her. But as it turns out, she had already passed away in 2007. This was unfortunate for Abbott, but he decided he could perhaps look to see if she had any children and contact them instead. Well, as it turns out, she did have children. As you remember, she was pregnant during the initial investigation, and then she actually gave birth to that child, a son named Robin. Then in the 1950s, Jo got married and had a child with that husband, and that was a daughter named Kate. Abbott was particularly interested in that son, Robin, however. The timing of his birth and the fact that his father was unknown, along with the still unknown connection between the Somerton Man and Jo, made Abbott a little bit suspicious. He wanted to contact Robin directly, but unfortunately, again, Robin had actually just recently passed away in 2009. Still though, Abbott did all he could to learn about Robin. As it turns out, Robin was a professional ballet dancer during his life with the Australian Ballet. And I'm sure you can imagine the light bulb moment that just struck Abbott at that point when he figured this out. Is it just a wild coincidence that the doctor at the autopsy suggested the Somerton Man was a ballet dancer, and here we have Robin, Jo Thompson's son, grow up to become a successful ballet dancer? Or could there be something more to this connection? Well, this forced Abbott to dig a little bit deeper. He pulled up pictures of Robin and immediately saw some similarities between him and pictures of the Somerton Man. Using his connections at the university, Abbott began consulting around and dug up some pretty insane clues. Of course, what we have here, what Abbott's theory is that Jo Thompson and the Somerton Man at some point were lovers, and Robin here is the son between the two of them. But what more than ballet dancing similarities and maybe some feature similarities on the face could help prove it? Well, Abbott first consulted Massiege Henneberg, a professor of anatomy. And what Henneberg discovered is that through the photographs, both Robin and the Somerton Man have a strikingly unique ear feature. The upper ear, specifically the upper ear hollow, was larger than the lower ear hollow. It's a genetically inherited trait that is only present in about 1-2% of Caucasians. Then to compound this, Abbott also heard back from a consultation with dentistry experts and learned that both Robin and the Somerton Man shared a rare trait with teeth, and that they both lacked lateral incisors. They were just not there. Again, it's an extremely rare genetically inherited disorder that's called hypodontia. All of these things combined was enough for Abbott to say, okay, this is all no longer a coincidence. In fact, the odds that these two rare traits would occur in both Robin and the Somerton Man independently is around 1 in 20 million. And that's not even throwing into the equation that these independent men, so to speak, were both connected to Joe Thompson. Coincidentally, right? That would put the number even higher. I dare not even stab at a guess. Therefore, it is highly, highly likely that Robin was indeed the child of Joe Thompson and the Somerton Man. He went public with this theory and made huge waves. It really reignited the spark of interest in the case. The theory was mostly met with support, but to finally prove the connection, it would take DNA evidence. And this DNA evidence would really rely on what the family of Joe Thompson wanted to do. Of course, we still have the daughter Kate. In addition to this, we have Robin's wife, Roma, and their own child to consider. So Abbott dug and decided to keep going, keep investigating. First, he wanted to meet with Robin's daughter to see if any of these genetic traits had been passed down to her. So in steps Rachel Egan into the story. She actually also has a strong passion for ballet. And what's more, she also has a strong passion to getting to the bottom of this case. And that's something that bears mentioning, is that with all these family members, there are some who try to distance themselves from anything having to do with the Somerton Man. But then there's Rachel here that desperately wants to solve it. And after all, if this genealogy, if this theory is true, then the Somerton Man is actually Rachel's grandfather. So Abbott and Rachel meet up to discuss the case, the theory, and discuss the topic of potential DNA testing. And in an absolutely unforeseen fairy tale turn of events, Professor Abbott and Rachel fall in love. Fast forward a bit and they are married with several children of their own. So needless to say, Abbott is really truly 100% a part of this story now. He really dug himself in there. But this marriage also created more distance between other family members that already didn't want to anything to do with the Somerton Man case. So let's take, for instance, Kate. This is Joe Thompson's daughter, right? Joe Thompson had the son, Robin, and a daughter later on, Kate. Now, there, you know, obviously could be some questions that Kate can answer. She's still alive. She lived with Joe Thompson for most of her life. Well, Kate is a lot less willing to enter the public eye, and some of the only information that we have from her came from one interview, a 60 Minutes interview, in which she accepted and spoke briefly about her mother, Jo. And I'll play a quick clip of that interview for you here. You can also get insight into Kate's own theory about her mother.
She said to me she knew who he was, but she wasn't going to let that out of the bag, so to speak.
You pretty much do accept that she was a spy.
I think so, yes. She had a dark side. And a very strong dark side.
That 60 Minutes episode was great because it got interviews from across the whole family. And it also illuminated the disagreement that they hold between one another about what to do with this case. On the one hand, you have Rachel and Professor Abbott, who desperately want to get to the bottom of identifying the man. To prove their theory, it would require exhuming, on the surface, it would require exhuming both Robin and the Somerton Man to test their DNA and compare. But it could also be possible, without exhuming Robin, to test Rachel's DNA, only exhume the Somerton Man, and then hopefully prove that he is her grandfather, and then going further prove that Robin was indeed the son. But then on the other side, you have Kate, who doesn't need or want any of this exhumation, who isn't necessarily eager to find out that her brother was actually truly a half-brother all along, and also wants Robin to rest in peace without tabloids and conspiracy theorists running his name all over the internet. And the final piece of the puzzle here is the fact that there is a lengthy governmental process that would be required to gain legal authority to exhume the Somerton Man. So for many years, the case was frustratingly stuck. However, in 2016, it was actually Robin's wife, Roma Egan, who came through to push the case along a little bit when she agreed to have her DNA tested and subtracted against Rachel's DNA to pinpoint the portion of DNA that must have come from Robin and thus may have come from the Somerton Man. So it's a lot of steps there. Clearly, it's not going to give anything too precise, the results of this DNA test. But what they did find is that Robin's father's DNA, the Somerton man's, presumably the Somerton man's DNA, has several links to the eastern United States. And actually, a fun fact, it was even found that this link is a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson, one of the founding fathers of America. So all of this linkage to America could perhaps point to the idea that the Somerton man was actually American. This would coincide with the original pathologist report that said his hairstyle and clothing style matched that of an American during that time. And interesting development to be sure, but we're not quite there yet. The true and of course most direct way to identify the Somerton man would just be to exhume him directly and test the DNA there. However, as I said, this is a process that's hopelessly tied up in bureaucracy, and several efforts at gaining approval for the exhumation have already been rejected. And then this is where a bit of a time crunch begins to set in, because experts believe that if we want to recover quality, testable DNA from the Somerton man, his body would have to be exhumed really soon. It's been over 70 years since his death, so in the not-so-distant future, our chance to test his DNA will be forever lost. There has been a lot of public support in recent years about the possibility of an exhumation, so much so actually that in 2019, conditional approval was finally achieved for this exhumation, and the last I've heard about it, it's now simply a matter of securing funds and, of course, probably letting this COVID pandemic get out of the way so that we can move forward with it. But for now, as I make this podcast, the grave of the Somerton man still sits undisturbed at West Terrace Cemetery in Adelaide, Australia. His ominous gravestone reads, "Here lies the unknown man who was found at Somerton Beach, 1st December 1948. So how about it then? Through all of this information, have you begun to form your own theory? If not, that's okay, because now is the time in the episode when I begin to list out the current popular theories that are already out there surrounding this case, and then of course, I'll end it off with my own theory on the elusive solution to this infamous 70 plus year mystery of the Somerton man. So first, let's start off with perhaps the most straightforward theory that exists. The theory that the Somerton man died of completely natural causes in an unfortunate accidental death. The exact nature of this accidental death varies, as I've seen several possibilities thrown out there, such as an accidental drug overdose, a sudden cardiac event from a pre-existing heart problem, a deadly stroke, a heat stroke, but probably most interesting, I've seen the idea of positional asphyxiation. Positional asphyxiation is a death in which the anatomical positioning of head, neck, torso, and overall body leads to poor circulation of blood and oxygen about the body to the point where normal function can no longer continue and death follows suit. The idea of positional asphyxiation, you guys try to say it, it's really hard, is only more recently being better understood, but during the time of the Somerton man death, it was definitely not something that was talked about. The pathologists and the coroner and the doctors around the case never even really threw it out as a possibility. And you have to remember, the position in which the Somerton man was, it was very, very odd. His head was propped up against the back wall at a very, very steep angle, meaning, according to this theory, it's possible that he was inadvertently cutting off airflow through his windpipe, and that led to suffocation. Obviously, if you or me were to try this position right now, right, we wouldn't be able to hold the position forever. Like, we wouldn't be able to hold it until we pass out, you know, because we could fix it. But the idea is that this position that he was in killed him in combination with something else, like perhaps like an accidental drug overdose that rendered him incapacitated to the point that he couldn't move from that unfortunate position. This theory would also line up with the fact that the chemist testing found absolutely no traces of common poison in his body, and that's because there really was no poison. As I've touched on briefly, many other theories still hold true to the idea that poisoning did indeed take place, but it was just a rare poison that didn't show up on the tests. But at the end of the day, that was actually, you know, never proven. The idea just became so popular because the pathologist and the lead investigator of the case pushed it so hard. They believed it. And, you know, they really truly believed that it was a rare, fast-acting, heart-targeting poison, such as digitalis or strophanthin. And thus, that is what many modern theories hold on to. But if we are to surmise that they could have been wrong in this assumption, then we are left with, you know, natural causes of death. Perhaps his distended liver and bloody stomach are actually just consequences of a pre-existing condition that he was dealing with that ended up killing him there on that beach. However, the biggest hole in this theory is the fact that we still have no explanation as to why he strangely had all the tags from his clothing removed, why he had this strange code in the Rubaiyat, why he may have left fake names in his luggage, why he had no forms of identification on him, and why it seems that he went to such lengths to keep his identity hidden. It seems really, really odd. This behavior seems very odd for someone who accidentally died of natural causes. If it was an unforeseen accident, how can you explain all of this setup? You would also have to believe that the coroner would have not been able to identify any of these causes of death we've been talking about. Like, if it was a stroke from a blood clot in the brain, the doctors there are literally trained professionals that should have been able to identify that. You'd have to believe that the natural cause of death was just so uncommon, maybe, or that the coroner and doctor were just incompetent at their jobs and they couldn't identify something that was natural. So it's a bit of a give and take with this theory, but I'll go ahead and move on to the next popular explanation. This is the unfortunate theory of suicide. As I alluded to earlier, the main driving force behind this explanation is the Tamam Shud note that was left in his pocket. It is finished, or the end, as a rough translation. This could explain also why he seems to have no regard for his belongings before his death, you know, tossing a book into a random car, having no wallet on him, you know, maybe he tossed this away too somewhere randomly into the garbage or something. He had some sort of poison on him, perhaps digitalis or strophanthin already with him. He found a nice spot on a beach, laid down, lit up a cigarette, and carried it out. The only clue left behind is this sort of suicide note that was in his pocket to Mom Should. Now, this seems straightforward enough, but people who hold this theory take it 6 million different directions from here, six million different angles, right? Some say that it was a case of being rejected by Joe Thompson. Perhaps, and follow the chronology here, he and Joe had met during the war. Maybe he was a soldier traveling around, maybe even from America, which could explain the preliminary DNA testing and his American appearance. Perhaps they kindled a relationship together, and at some point Joe Thompson gave him this book as a gift with her phone number in the back. We already know that she did this once with Alfred Boxall, remember? And it was a past lover of hers. So maybe that was kind of her MO. She kind of falls for a guy, and then she liked to give them this collection of Persian love poems as a gift. She did it several times. Humans are creatures of habit, after all. So perhaps he comes back to Australia after the war is over to see her. Maybe even he got her pregnant at that time with this future baby Robin. However, around this time too, Joe starts maybe a serious relationship with another man, or for whatever reason, you know, loses interest in our poor old Summerton man. And so maybe one night he shows up at her doorstep shouting her name, something we all know that did happen. And when she continued to reject him time and time again, and he wasn't going to maybe be a father to baby Robin, he kind of threw his hands up in the air and gave up. And as a final act, he kind of ripped those final words from the back of her gift and tossed it away, ending his days right there on Summerton Beach with an uncommon poison that he had on him. This still doesn't fully explain, however, the secrecy behind him obscuring his identity. Some have taken this and said, well, this was intentional. Maybe it was a way to ensure that his friends and family back home never find out. And also perhaps why, if he wanted his suicide note to be found, why is it tucked away so deeply in a small, semi-hidden pocket? And are we to believe that he just somehow had access to these rarely used poisons, just kind of willy-nilly? Why in that way, right? And another small detail, if we are to believe he indeed used one of these fast-acting poisons, then where's the bottle? Where's the receptacle that it was in? Because it certainly wasn't nearby him. Are we going to say that he went to great lengths to hide this, too? See, there are several patterns of his behavior here that do indeed follow common patterns of suicide, but also several that absolutely do not follow any common patterns. And what about that later testimony from a potential witness that said he may have seen a man carrying another man on his shoulders near the water's edge? Well, if we are to believe this testimony, then we can definitely entertain this next theory. Here we have the theory of a murder, that the Somerton man was murdered in cold blood. Presumably, the murderer is the guy seen carrying a man on his shoulder the night the Somerton man died. But who is this silhouette of a man, and why did he do it? Well, if we continue on with the love affair idea from the last theory, perhaps this man was Joe Thompson's current significant other. Perhaps the Somerton man traveled to Joe, confronted her, and was rejected by not only her, but aggressively rejected by the current boyfriend. Then perhaps there was a conflict, maybe even a violent one. Did Joe and her boyfriend decide the only way to handle the situation was to kill him? Was he deranged? This could explain why there was a great deal of effort to obscure his identity. The tearing of the tags, the lack of items on his person, and also when later questioned by police why Joe Thompson was so evasive and resolute that she did not know the man. She even gave them a deliberate false lead by giving the name Alfred Boxall to throw police off their tracks. Or maybe even more sinisterly, he died while at Joe Thompson's house, and she went through all the effort of removing tags, removing belongings, and then has that boyfriend carry him to the beach, complete with planting a half-smoked cigarette at his lips. I tend to shy away from this particular explanation that he died at her house for two reasons, or three reasons, I guess. One, because we have that witness saying that he saw the Somerton man raise his hand in the air, remember? So I do think he was actually kind of laying on the beach when he died. He was alive for a little bit there. Two, while Joe Thompson's house was close to the beach, it was still over 800 meters. So carrying a dead body over your shoulder that far seems a bit far-fetched. And, you know, it seems very risky, too, to have the idea for three to carry someone over 800 meters, right? You could be seen, which maybe he did, so. And what if, you know, let's continue on with the murder theory here. What if there wasn't a man connected to Joe at all? The story given by the man who found the Rubaiyat in his car was a little suspicious. Now, I wasn't around in Australia in 1948, but who leaves a car parked near a beach for extended periods of time with the windows rolled down? It seems a little weird. Is there a chance that he could have been hiding something? So perhaps it's not a man connected to Joe, but it's a man beyond. It was a man connected to the Somerton man, and Joe really is just innocent in this whole scenario. Is it that guy with the car that could be involved? Or what if there was no other man at all in the scenario? If the witness seeing the man over the shoulder thing isn't true, then perhaps it was Joe herself acting alone that conspired to secretly poison the Somerton man. He came over, wanted to talk, perhaps about the child, and she decided that this was the course of action. Again, at this time, Joe Thompson was working as a nurse. She had extensive experience nursing during the war. She may have had access to these rather rare substances that could have been used to untraceably poison the Somerton man. Maybe he eventually leaves the house feeling unwell, doesn't know he's been poisoned, and decides to go lie down on the beach. How far would Joe Thompson then go to keep the police off her tail? Would she plant his briefcase at the train station as a distraction with all these items that kind of meant nothing? You know, this could also account why there's no poison receptacle found at the scene, because it was all taken at Joe's house. But a lot of these possibilities are getting, you know, a little bit hard to believe, to think that Joe Thompson was secretly a brilliant mastermind that had every step of the equation figured out ahead of time, and succeeded, no less. Outsmarted the police, outsmarted everyone. Is this a probable explanation? Or perhaps it would have taken a little bit of help to pull all of this off. Some bigger organization, like, say, perhaps a secret agency within a government. Maybe you fall into the same belief that Joe's own daughter holds, that Joe and the Somerton man were actually Cold War spies. So yes, the next theory here is the ever-popular idea that what we have is the consequence of spy activity. The idea that Joe and or the Somerton man were operating as undercover spies, and for one reason or another, it led to the death of the Somerton man. Clearly, the circumstances around him kind of absolutely scream spy. the well-groomed nature, the muscularity of foreign appearance, the tags ripped from his clothing, the lack of identification in general, the secretive nature, and the rare untraceable poison that may have been used, and last but not least, obviously, the cryptic code that's left in the back of the Rubaiyat. And it may seem all kind of disconnected to us now, but remember, this is the beginning of the Cold War. There are agents from different governments and countries traveling all over the world that are carrying out espionage. And what's more, there are actually several known cases of people dying during the Cold War with tags of clothing removed from them, and then later they were proven to actually be spies, such as Captain Ulrich von der Osten in 1941. So, therefore, this is kind of a known spy MO to remove tags to hide identities, right? Perhaps the only difference with the Somerton man here is that it was never actually definitively proven that he was a spy afterwards. And then what about Joe? What potential evidence do we have that maybe she was a spy? Well, the evidence is actually probably better on her end. For instance, we know that she was a communist, or at least had communist leanings, and she knew Russian. There are even some reports that she taught Russian, the Russian language, to students while in Australia. So this connects her to perhaps being a spy for the Soviet Union. Moreover, in that same 60 Minutes interview that I showed you earlier, her daughter, Kate, actually came out in a different clip and recalled one conversation that she had with her mother about the Somerton man. There weren't many, but she recalls one. She remembers her mother saying something along the lines of, "They will never solve the case, because the truth is only known at a level higher than the police force," insinuating that it was at a top governmental level, and it was being kept secret there. And so, perhaps, follow me here, what if there was some forbidden love that was going on here between Joe, who maybe was a Soviet spy, and the Somerton man, who maybe was an American spy, and they had this forbidden love affair. And in the end, it resulted in Joe taking the upper hand and poisoning him. Were there maybe other people in the equation, other spies, a ring of spies, right? Was the Somerton man maybe being chased down, which could explain why he's buying train tickets and bus tickets, some that he never uses. He's keeping things hidden in hidden pockets. He's writing in code in the back of an obscure book. And maybe whoever was chasing him finally got to him. And, you know, maybe he, in a last-ditch effort to hide something, threw the Rubaiyat into an open car window as he was running away. And he finally got killed there on the beach. But it was expert work, right? And that's why we still don't have his identification. And in this scenario, it wasn't Joe who killed him at all. Maybe they were even still in love, and the only reason that she couldn't help the police was because it might actually lead to her blowing her own cover. And, you know, when she was shown the Somerton man's face, she almost fainted because that was the man that she still loved. As you can see, there are countless directions you can take the spy theory. Some directions are more believable than others, but this next theory I'll jump into here takes it to the next level, in that it is probably the most far-fetched of them all, but that doesn't have to mean that it isn't true nonetheless. Last but not least, I will now give you the explanation that maybe the Somerton man and or Joe were involved in a highly secretive cult, a cult involving the Rubaiyat. A lot of strange behaviors around the death can be explained by the strange tendencies of cult activity. Keeping identities secret, never talking to authorities, strange substances even. And most of all, the unbreakable code in the back of the Rubaiyat that's, you know, that just seems to be popping up everywhere in Australia at this point. I mean, again, this is a 12th century collection of Persian poems. Why does it seem like half the continent has it? And why is it being connected to multiple dead men? Because again, you have that case of George Marshall, who died right around the exact same time, also on a beach, with a copy of the Rubaiyat open on his chest. Furthermore, work done by popular author Gary Feltis shows that the copy of the Rubaiyat that the Somerton man possessed was not common at all. It was practically one of a kind, because, you know, think about published books, right, that you'd find on a bookstore if you're going to look for Harry Potter or something. You have hundreds of thousands of one of this mass-produced copy, and maybe you have some special edition copies with special cover art versions here and there. But the copy of the Rubaiyat that was owned by the Somerton man was so exceedingly rare that actually no one has been able to find an exact matching version anywhere else in the world. was Jo Thompson, perhaps the leader of this cult, and she was handing out these special copies of this obscure book to people that she deemed worthy, and there's like a whole secret code to go along with it. Can this explain maybe why she changed her name so many times throughout her life? And actually, now thinking about it, it makes me wonder if Jo Thompson could have actually been able to crack that code in the back of the Somerton Man's book. Like, she may have actually been one of the only human beings that could have cracked that code, and it's since lost now. But anyways, that's a question that we will never really know for sure. Did the Somerton Man maybe break some sort of rule within the cult that then led to his death as the reason that he actually had to die? When Jo was speaking to her daughter, Kate, about, you know, only a higher level knows the truth, perhaps she was actually talking about this secret society, this cult that she was a part of that was that higher level. If this really is the case, then the members of this so-called cult have definitely kept tight lips through it all. And, you know, not one iota of a whisper more than just circumstance and coincidence in this theory. Okay, so that covers all of the main theories. And of course, there's always more out there. Like, it's a case of transient global amnesia. He forgets where he is, forgets who he is. The idea that the Somerton Man actually worked as a spy for the Australian government, and then this death was actually part of a giant cover-up and conspiracy orchestrated by the Australian government. Maybe Jo Thompson was a serial killer, and he was a victim, etc., etc. But where do you land on this? What is your theory to explain it all? Keep formulating it in your mind as I take this opportunity to venture my own guess at what could possibly solve the monumental Somerton Man mystery. Alright, when it comes to the mystery of the Somerton Man, there are infinitely many angles when you look at solving it. But I think there are a few resolute truths in the mix that cannot be denied, and should help formulate an explanation that manages to check all of the boxes. For one, Robin is most definitely the child of Jo Thompson and the Somerton Man. The genetic evidence is just too strong to deny. Secondly, someone was definitely trying to hide the Somerton Man's identity. And third, his death was most certainly unnatural. A case of poisoning is highly likely, I believe, and, you know, the pathologist was right in this regard. Beyond that, things get really, really subjective beyond those three truths in my mind. And honestly, I went back and forth on this, on what I believe, several times throughout this case and researching it. It took many afternoons of me staring out my window to come to any kind of conclusion, but I think I finally did it. And what brought me to my conclusion was by trying to put myself in the shoes of the Somerton Man. Based on everything I know about him, what can I surmise about his intentions, right? His emotions, his heart. At the very beginning of this episode, I said that one of the biggest first steps in solving a case is always, always, always learning everything you can about the victim. And while the Somerton Man case leaves actually very few solid facts of knowledge about him, right? He does leave a pretty substantial trace related to his personality, his thoughts, his behavior in that regard. And what I realized is that this can be just as useful in solving it. So with that being said, my theory is as follows. The Somerton Man essentially was an absolute romantic. All right, so as I go through this explanation, I'm gonna romanticize it a bit in fitting spirit. So follow me here, chronologically. He's an American. Also, he's just habitually well-groomed and stylish. And he's a talented ballet dancer before he is enlisted to fight during World War II, probably in the Navy. Therefore, he's sailing around, going from base to base, and at some point, he makes it to the same place where a young nurse is working, a young Jo Thompson, who is also developing her communist sympathies while treating all of these wounded men, and maybe also learning Russian during this time. They meet. Maybe they bond over a love for ballet and fall head over heels for each other. Maybe mostly, though, it's the Somerton Man that is hopelessly infatuated with her. I mean, absolutely, inescapably in love with her. The problem is that he's only stationed there for so long. They have to part ways. But before he goes, she gives him a special copy of the Rubaiyat, full of classic, moving love poems, and her phone number, telling him to, you know, come to Adelaide after it's all over. So a short time passes, and the Summerton man, who has missed her dearly and thought about her every day since, finally gets that chance. He packs up, maybe he packs up some hand-me-down clothes, perhaps from a friend named Keen, and other various objects that kind of mean nothing, and arrive in this foreign place in Adelaide, and gives her a call. But when she hears his voice, she wants nothing to do with him. See, upon returning home, she, Jo, has fallen in love into a very stable relationship with another man. And as it turns out, she's actually pregnant at this time with what she highly suspects to be the Summerton man's child. So she's kind of slightly ashamed. She wants to put all of this behind her. She wants to stick with this stable relationship she found now. And she wants to be rid of what happened to start fresh with this new man and raise the child on her own without the Summerton man. So she says all this over the phone, and at hearing this, the Summerton man is kind of knocked sideways, right? But he loves her, and he may, you know, also want part in raising this child. But she hangs up without anything more. So he panics. He needs to find her. So he asks around, he does everything he can to find out where Jo Thompson lives. Someone finally manages to help him and give him directions. He has nothing to write on, though, so he flips open to the only thing he has on him, the back cover of the Rubaiyat, and he hurriedly writes down his own way to remember directions, perhaps something he picked up during the war. So to us, it just looks like gibberish, but to him, perhaps it's directions, like turn right under the bridge would be T-R-U-T-B, or something to this effect, and maybe he messes up a couple times, he scratches out a line. It's unbreakable because it really truly only means something to him. He was hurriedly scratching it down as he's getting verbal instructions, and so he's doing his best. He buys a train ticket to this location, and then an eventual return train ticket that he actually never ends up using. Once he gets there, he then takes a bus from the train station to the Summerton Beach area, but he leaves his briefcase at the train station, fully intending to return to it. The only things that he brings with him are his wallet, the Rubaiyat, his prescribed heart medicine that he will need and takes every night, and some cigarettes. He finally walks his way to Jo Thompson's house and knocks on the door. She sees that it's him and doesn't answer. She won't let him in, and he becomes distraught. He yells out to her, begs to let him in, begs her to talk to him, to maybe even talk about helping raise this child. But time and time again, she refuses. She doesn't want to ruin this new relationship, this new life she has here. She tells him once and for all, you know, you will never see me again. You will never be a father to this child. And he can't believe it. This was everything to him. This was going to be his whole life. What is he to do now? He has nowhere to go, no job, and in his eyes, no future. He is absolutely dejected. The love that he created in his mind is in tatters. He stumbles away from her house in shambles. He doesn't know where to go or what to do. He's already missed his train back, maybe. He opens up the copy of the Rubaiyat and laments at the final words on the last page. He rips them out and then makes a decision in his mind. He continues to walk on, feeling no need for his belongings anymore. He defiantly throws the symbol of this past love, right, the Rubaiyat, into an open window of a car as he walks by. And, you know, he's romantic, right? He throws his wallet into a trash can even, maybe. And in one last thought about the world around him, he decides that he doesn't want his friends and family back home in the States knowing about this, knowing how it ended. So he decides to hastily rip off the tags of his clothing and throw them away as well. He makes it to a beach as the sun is setting, and here's as good a place as any, as he figures, right? He takes out the bottle of his heart medicine, probably a type of digitalis, and downs the whole thing. Then throws that bottle away too into a trash can. He lights a cigarette as the sun sets, but he never makes it to the end of it, and his heart gives way in the night, and as the sun rises, there's this mysterious Summerton man dead on the beach. Later, when police are putting together the clues and Jo Thompson is contacted, she clearly recognizes the man. She can't believe that he did this. But still, she's not going to jeopardize her life at this point. She denies, and she even gives the name Alfred Boxall as a red herring to investigators. She raises the child, Robin, and he, with ballet in his blood, so to speak, becomes a professional ballet dancer. While she likes to maybe want to leave this whole Summerton man thing in the past, she sometimes passingly mentions things to her daughter, and or maybe her daughter overhears Kate, like that only a level higher than the police could possibly know the truth. And that's her. She is the level higher than the police because she outsmarted them. Again, Kate has said that her mother had a dark side, and years pass on like this until eventually Professor Derek Abbott reignites the case by linking Robin as the love child between Summerton Man and Joe. And that, my listeners, is where it stands today. In the very near future here, if the exhumation goes through, we may finally have definitive answers. And to be honest, I think an exhumation is the right thing to do. This man, the Summerton Man, lived an entire life that we have absolutely no knowledge of. No one deserves to have a life full of everything that makes us human just to end up 6 feet beneath the ground with a gravestone that reads, "Here lies the unknown man." Let his story be told. And soon enough, we may just get this. We may actually finally have the answers. The solution to Australia's greatest enigma, the historic mystery of the Summerton Man. Listeners, I hope beyond hope that you have enjoyed another episode of History's Great Mysteries. I definitely have a lot of fun with these straightforward, like, whodunit type mysteries, and it also makes me very eager to hear all of the theories that are out there. So again, I will extend an always open invitation to voice your own theory, either by messaging me, commenting me on the Facebook page, or even just talking to your friends about it or anything in between. It's always good to just have open conversation about it. But anyways, as for today, that is all I have for you. I want to give one more giant thank you just for simply being a listener of these podcasts. As I said in the beginning, I do hope to be back as soon as I possibly can. So be on the lookout. Keep up with my Facebook page to be kept in the loop. Also, a quick shout out to Kane, who re-sparked my attention and interest into this case. Thank you for that. And I hope you all have a great rest of your day. Thank you for spending some of it with me. And until I am back, of course, I ask that you guys stay curious and revel in some of the beautiful unknowns of this world. Bye now.